Hello and welcome to Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin here with Teos Abadia. Hey, Teos, we are getting right into it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I have some bad news, Teos. Today will be the last day that we record Mastering Dungeons. So I
Oh
know this is
man.
probably news to you.
You
And
should have told me. I mean, I'm already suffering from my Duke loss, and you're gonna,
yeah.
this is gone. I mean, what even is the point of life?
I
Let's
know.
see. I don't keep any alcohol in the office. It's just
Okay,
gonna be coffee.
I'm gonna have a sip where, oh, I've got to go get my mug. Here we go.
Well, Sean's
Cheers
gone. I
to,
hate him. Oh,
yeah.
he's back. Yeah.
And also today's April 1st, so happy April Fool's Day to everyone. And this will definitely not be our last podcast, as much as that might be a boon to both of us and our various sanities. We are here for the long haul. So if this is your first time listening, welcome
So
to how
sorry.
we, yes, and we apologize ahead of time for anything you are about to hear. But we are going to get right into it with our listener corner, where we start with Andy Demps, friend of the show and one of our Patreon backers, via the Patreon Discord, asking, if you were designing a reference curriculum for adventure design, what adventures would you pick and what would each one highlight? And I read this question and I thought, okay, this is going to take me 12 hours of research to answer. And then I decided I'm not going to do 12 hours of research on this. So what I will say is this, the challenge of this question isn't that there aren't great adventures out there, because there are so many, and we've reviewed many of them. It's often more instructive to look at the flaws in an adventure to see what it's done well, but then to show the instruction manual nature of an adventure not quite hitting the mark in terms of what the game master needs in order to run the adventure as the adventure expects it to be run. If that makes sense. And often you don't know if an adventure will work until you actually run it. You could read something and say, this is great, I have all the information. And then as soon as the players start inputting or asking questions, you realize, oh, this adventure leaves a lot out. What are your thoughts along those lines before I dive into my answers here?
So I like it. I like your concept of needing flaws. I think that's really true. This question could be, hey, what adventures are the best that showcase how to write adventures? But that might not, as you say, really help you understand it. And what might actually be better is to look at comparing and contrasting how things do it. And that's what I would probably do is not just choose a flaw, but also some two different approaches, right? And why does it work in this particular place? And why does it work and does it not work this way? Or this one has A and B advantages, this one has C and D advantages, right? And that's where you get into the heart of learning about encounter design, adventure design, rule design, all those kinds of things, is being able to compare and contrast those techniques.
Yeah. And so what I thought we would do is go through some adventures that we've learned lessons from to show this. When Teos and I, once upon a time, were reviewing adventures from not just fifth edition days, but going all the way back, as well as adventures from other editions or even other games. We heard time and time again that the Great Modron March was a seminal, awesome, great adventure. And we went into that thinking, okay, let's show what's great about this adventure. And once we actually sat down and read it, we both sat there, sort of, I think, individually on our own, going, wait, this isn't really good, but I must be missing something because everyone loves this adventure. And so when we got together to review it, I feel like we were like hesitant to say what was on our minds until we finally both were brave enough, I guess, to just say, hey, it was a great idea. And maybe that's why it's so well loved, because everyone loves Modrons and it's got this multiplanar thing that was new for its time. But in terms of as a user manual for a DM to run a game, it was not great. In fact, far from it.
And Dragonlance too, right? It was one where we wanted to really be excited. You know, what did the Hickmans cook up? We love their work. And I had run that adventure, and I remember kind of struggling with it, but I don't remember much more than that. And reading it was just it was surprising to really go, oh wow, this adventure has some brilliant things it's trying to do and some deep, deep flaws. And so you learn a lot from that.
If I had to answer Andy's question, I would say The Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh for me was a good adventure to show how to take a very simple idea and make it into a way where the game master, whether they're, a really experienced game master or even a new game master, can understand the actual content of the adventure and how to run it in a way that is fun for the players.
Yeah, I find Saltmarsh to be the closest thing to a perfect adventure that is an old adventure because it will work for almost everybody. And what it's trying to do is not, spectacularly difficult, but it just does it so well, right? Creepy house with a secret. It does that really well. It delivers a D&D experience. It's what you probably want to look at if you're going to design something basic for new players, right? Then this is a great template to follow and look at and see why does this work so well? Why does it not overextend and fail the way other things do? Yeah.
I thought the City of Omu chapter of Tomb of Annihilation and then the actual tomb itself were great in giving DMs a blueprint for a type of adventure where they're sent to a location and there's lots of things happening in the location, but they have a goal, which is find this tomb and enter it. So the game master, it's a blueprint for a user manual where the game master can do lots of different things, but all of those different options are right there. And while it doesn't necessarily spell out, here's how you run an adventure here, it's pretty obvious that if you want to get involved with all of the different factions and you want to do that, you can do so, or you can just go to the tomb. And then those opening levels of the tomb, I think, are a great like death trap dungeon. It may be a little long for groups. But at least, it gives you that blueprint for how to do it.
Yeah, and I think that gets into that what I was saying of the compare and contrast, right? Like Storm King's Thunder is one where the traps in that adventure I find to be really just like I don't know what they're doing other than just dispensing with damage. And the experience is sort of like, hey, that happened to you. Okay, I guess it did. I have experienced it. I didn't feel particularly engaged, but I have taken damage and that felt wrong. And that rolling ball flattened me. And yeah, that was bad. Whereas if you look at something like Tomb of Annihilation, the traps in that are engaging, right? They are puzzle piece-like rooms and devices that make you think, what should I do? Should I pull this lever? Should I walk on the yellow squares or the black squares? Could I fly, and maybe you can't do any of these things. And that kind of thing that tickles your brain, right? This is a showcase of that kind of design, which builds upon the Tomb of Horrors kind of concept, but in a less punishing, more interesting way. I tried to do that kind of design in Dungeon of Doom, right? So I think it's really interesting to compare things like those adventures, Dungeon of Doom, Tomb of Annihilation, to these others that just dish out damage and what is the point of those, right? In a similar fashion, I like to look at, I find that, and I think about this a lot, Icespire Peak, the town and how you get these quests, Lost Mines of Phandelver or Lost Mine of Phandelver and how you get quests in that, or Princes of the Apocalypse Red Larch section. And they're very different approaches, and you can learn a lot by looking at those three and comparing them, right? The kind of quest board concept does a great job of sort of pacing, right? Lost Mine actually really overwhelms you, but it has these really interesting pieces, but it just can be a lot for a DM. And the quests that naturally come out of there aren't particularly engaging. Whereas Red Larch, I think, has some really engaging quests, and it does this really interesting thing where it has kind of keywords that if you are on one or another storyline, there are little bits that the NPCs can tell you, which means that later when you unlock the second storyline, these NPCs can continue to serve a function because they now have more information, more angles based on where you are. And that's a really neat design, right? So I love comparing those three things.
Yeah, I had the same note about Dragons of Icespire Peak, right? It's an interesting way to, for new DMs to learn how to manage a campaign, right? You can do it in rather than one long story, you can do it in short bursts that will naturally turn into a longer story. So, right, those are some things. What other adventures did you think about there?
There's no perfect adventure, and it's interesting. You know, like people really love Strahd, right? Curse of Strahd has done really well. It's sold really well. It's a fan favorite. But when I try to think of the individual pieces that work well outside of the, say, the Taroka deck mechanic, or you know, the revolutionary design around the villain that it changed, you know, I don't know that there are individual parts that really excite me and make me happy the way those in other adventures. If I look at encounter design, I might look at something like Wild Beyond the Witchlight. I think that those encounters have really good open design. It's something Will Doyle and Stacy very good at doing. They know how to create what I like to call potential energy, right? That the scene is charged up with these things that you, just hearing it, want to engage with and want to unlock and unleash upon the scene, for good or ill, sometimes both. And that's really fun, right? It just naturally calls you in as a player and makes you want to participate and do things with it. And those are kinds of design that I've tried to do in my work often. I think Cloud Giant's Bargain is one of the ones where I've best done that. Thinking it deliberately based on those kinds of things. You know, what happens when you walk into the kitchens and all the goblins just stop and look at you in the middle of cooking? You know, what do you do with that when you're trying to sneak into a place, right? Those kinds of things. You walk into a sauna and the fog is so thick that no one can see you. And there's a cloud giant in there, but they're old and they can't see you and they can't quite hear you well. You know, what do you say to this person that says, "Hey, who's there?" Right? That kind of stuff is memorable because of that. And Will and Stacy do that just in droves in Wild Beyond the Witchlight. So I'd really look at that for encounter design.
There you go. Thank you for that question. Next question from Alan Tucker via the Patreon Discord. I watched a video from the D20 Play Guys and saw Graham Ward and Teos commenting live as well. So here's a question for the show. With MCDM and Daggerheart, along with other games, going to non-initiative systems, why are so many people focused on worrying if players will try to take advantage of it and overwhelm the table? And my answer is it's because so many people will try to take advantage of it and overwhelm the table. Because if you're not careful, there are people out there who will do that. And it's not, I won't say it's not a negative thing. It's not an evil thing, right? They're not doing it to destroy people's fun. They're doing it because that's how they have fun. If you've run for more than a dozen people, you have probably come across a player who will tell other people what to do, try to take the spotlight as much as possible, et cetera, et cetera. What a initiative system like D&D does is it gives everyone a chance to act. And it gives you as the game master that structure to say, okay, Bob, you've done all the talking so far. Now you're not saying this, but you're thinking this. Okay, Bob, you've done everything. You've talked the entire time. Now we're going to go into a system where I can look at someone else and say, "What do you do?" Okay, great. What do you do? And if Bob, you try to speak, I can
Not your
say,
turn.
"Bob, it is not your turn." So it's a tool as a game master. It's also a tool as a game designer. Because if rules are machine, if games are machines, machines are built on structure. And that structure might not be perfect, but at least in that structure, you can start building rules around the structure. So when you want to make a game where an effect will last until the end of a character's next turn, you have a surety that that character's next turn will happen after everyone else goes. I am not against systems that don't have a step-by-step initiative order. I think there are many fine games that don't use that, but there is a reason that some games do.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about this a bit on our Patreon Discord, that it's interesting when you get to the initiative systems that like the what's called popcorn initiative, There are other names for it as well, but that idea where in initiative, the DM says, okay, the GM says that this person has sort of really initiated combat, so they're going to go first. And after they're done, that person, whether GM or a player, will pick who goes next. And this becomes, in theory, what it should do is just go with what's natural, right? So if my character went and I, shot at the vampire, and then I, I think my other buddy probably would go next because we're both, on the same page. And then that person will say, well, I think that I'm in a position where now the monster would go. And that's kind of, I think, what's sort of in the mentality. But what really ends up happening is the players, after a while of using the system, usually devolve into the, well, one of us gets to go now. We should all go. Except if we all go, then the monsters will go. And then the next round will kick in. And for round two, all the monsters will choose themselves again because that's optimal. Under focus fire rules, right? And deal damage, take things down now kind of mentality, tactics. That's what's going to happen. And so what usually ends up happening is most players go, they keep a couple in reserve, they let a couple monsters go, and then the players get to go at the start of the next turn. And it creates a sort of player heavy structure, which is not bad for some games. Some games where the players should be very powerful, it works great, but it sort of devolves into that. Apocalypse World tries to really say, like, look, what initiative? It's just, what does it make sense? Talk when it's your turn, and when the GM thinks the monsters would respond, that's when they respond, and we're not gonna worry about this. And the downside, as you said, is that, well, Bob might really dominate things, and Bob might try to go three times in a row. Or if you watch Acquisitions Incorporated, Viari will swing from the chandelier, run across the thing, pick up the blah blah blah, flip the lever, attack twice, run back across, and so on and so forth. And that's amusing for a show, but not great if you're the other players at the table, as we see watching Acquisitions Incorporated, where the others go, what the hell is happening? Can I take 40 turns too? And so that's the downside of it, right? And why we end up, I think, talking about this.
And if you take Rob Schwalb's Shadow of the Demon Lord type system, right, which is all right, those who do fast turns, you go first. Fast turn being, right, you don't move or certain actions. All right, everyone whose fast turn went, now the monster's fast turns. Okay, monsters went. Anyone with slow turns. Okay, now monster slow turns. So it's part, does it work for the story? It's part, does it work for the game? It's part, does it work for your group? And it's, part, what is best for making this transition between the story and the action as smooth as possible. So.
And I think that in with Daggerheart, I think part of what's getting into the conversation there, in addition to just its critical role, and so it's popular to think about it and talk about it, and analyze it and or knock it down, depending on what kind of people you are, it's that Daggerheart wants to be a narrative game, but has a lot of crunch. If it were more of a narrative game, then who goes is less important. But the more tactical stuff your character has, the more that initiative turn matters, right? You're not just doing a thing for story purposes. You can set things up for other players. You can do the area burst five that gets all things, but only if I go now. And hey, if I go again, I can do this thing, right? And that's where you end up in the, I might want to go three times in a row because I am the best person right now. And, in some movie scenes, that's great. In some novels, but generally not great at the table. You want to just say, I know it would be optimal if you went three times, but this is a team game and we want you to swap it up a bit more. So I think that's where with Daggerheart's design in particular, it gets talked about from those folks who are having a little more intelligent discourse about it, because it has that tactical angle to it that makes you want to go now versus later. And that can be dominating in play. So it is problematic at times, varying by table.
Sure. And finally, via YouTube, we get this from Matthew Snow. I'm looking forward to GMing for the first time. Awesome. Good luck with that. One of my players is a big fan of the disadvantage systems from GURPS since it provides a mechanical reward for choosing a drawback which he has to play or which may come back to bite him. He and I both feel that 5e's implementation of the DM inspiration for role-playing flaws may not be an adequately distinct benefit from all other sources of advantage in 5e. I'd considered a guaranteed critical to be used next session as a possible substitute. However, I can foresee that might be disruptive if it shuts down role-playing encounters or combat, which the rest of the group want to engage with. How would you go about designing a replacement for flaws in 5e? What kinds of mechanical incentives would you recommend to keep players engaging with it regularly? What considerations and pitfalls should we take into account when attempting to alter that system? Any thoughts you have would be greatly appreciated. This is a huge question, Matthew Snow. And so let's first of all explain what the GURPS disadvantage system is. In GURPS, you build your character, but I haven't played GURPS in like 30 years, so bear with me. You build your character based on a certain number of points that you can spend to get traits that are beneficial to you. The system also allows you to take negative traits, take flaws that give you back points that you can spend for more positive things. If that's a very succinct way of saying that. What my experience is with systems like this as is it brings out the very worst of the min-maxers who will search for flaws that they can either ignore or that aren't really flaws that really don't affect play much to get the extra points that they can put into things that affect things very, very much.
Yeah, I'll give you an
So,
example. So
go
in
ahead.
Shadowrun, I have had countless characters who had an allergy to some metal, aluminum, gold, whatever, and you can choose mild or severe or whatever and take points for this. Then you get benefits out of it, right? In my all of my play, I have had an allergy situation once across years and dozens of characters. It's just free points. And everybody playing the game knows that. And it's the worst. And Legend of the Five Rings has similar things, right? You know, like, oh, I'm opinionated. Oh, yeah, that has role playing implications. But now I get to do ridiculous damage with my katana, right? Like, it is problematic because you can't help. And I try to be a good player, but I can't help. And most people can't help themselves. But to make these kinds of decisions where the flaw is forgotten, the advantage is omnipresent. And that's the problem with these systems, right? Because what you ideally want is you want that the player wants to lean into the flaw. These kinds of systems tend not to do that, right? And Sean, you and I have talked about systems that do encourage you to lean into the flaws. Fate, right? With the aspects, right? You get a benefit for playing to your flaw, but it's not a broken benefit. It's a now, it's a seen benefit. And the reason you're doing it is because you're believing in the role-playing of it. And the characterization part of it, not on the you're not doing it just for the benefit, right?
So bringing up fate here is important because I think this idea in 5e of traits, ideals, personality trait, ideals, bonds, and flaws that are somehow tied to inspiration. And I think they took this, they being the designers of 5e, took it from games like Fate or games like it. And to explain this in just a hair, touch more detail, in Fate, you give your character aspects, which are short phrases that are a truth about your character. So you
Hot-headed.
may, right, you may be your primary trait might be, the greatest swordsman in the valley. That's your main trait. Then a trait, a trouble trait, they call it, is something that gets your character into trouble. It could be hot-headed, as Teo said. It could be wanted by the drug cartel, right? Something that you, and now you don't get any points. There's no points in this. These are just truths about your character that you create. Then during play, you have fate tokens or fate points. When you tap an aspect, when you say, all right, this aspect is going to come into play, you give the game master a fate point, and then you get a bonus to your roll, or you get to re-roll or something beneficial. However, you or the game master can also use those aspects against you if it's part of the story. Okay, you're in a negotiation right now, and if this negotiation goes well, you will win access to this thing that you want. However, you're hot-headed. So I'm going to say you fail at this. right? Or things are going to go very poorly for you in this because you are hot-headed. The narrative goes against you, but I'm going to give you back a fate token, a fate point that you will then be able to
Use in the future.
use in the future. So there's this transaction thing. It's not all at once at the beginning. It's a part of the game play. And I think that's what these aspects, traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws for D&D wanted to do, but they didn't spell it out,
No.
right?
Yeah. And D&D has too many, and we talked about this during our player's handbook review, but it has so many things that nobody can remember them, even for their own character, let alone that the DM or the players can remember it for the other players, right? My flaw, my bond, my ideal, my two personality traits, that's too much. Whereas Fate has just a couple of things, and it makes them very iconic. And so, going back to the question, especially for your, I mean, well, you can look at it two ways. One is, it's your first time DMing, do whatever you want, learn from it, have
That's
fun,
true.
perfectly fine to operate that way. The other is, hey, it's your first time, starting on a standard footing may be best, to where you can see the game a little more, feel a little more comfortable about it, and then see what kind of things you want to customize. Specifically on this area of sort of flaw type pieces, this may work fine for you, but it probably, and for most players, they're not going to lean into the disincentive part of it. They're going to lean into the power part of it. And it may not create the role playing that you want, because it ends up being really mechanical and feeling mechanical. And the real tough part, as 5e found out, is trying to say to the player, hey, here are the parts. Remember, these are the parts that you want to lean into story-wise, so that is becomes part of the fluency of the game, right? Of the normal construct of play. And that tends to not happen when it's too complicated. It needs to be really iconic. Fate does that well by just saying, like, you just know, like, hot-headed. Like, I can remember the things from a lot of my Fate characters because they're just a couple and they're clear, iconic. Or even better, 13th Age, with its one unique thing. It's such a simple thing to just say, this is the guiding principle of my character. And everything can come off of that because you just feel it. You know that that's your character. The more that you can get into that angle, the more that players will do those things. And so I would look to see how it could make these sort of more aspect-like, more clear, iconic things about the characters that everybody's going to absolutely know and remember. That's where you'll find your best play coming off of that.
And to the inspiration system is very simple, and it does work if you decide ahead of time how it is going to work. If you say, if you role play your character well and it leads to a detrimental outcome because you do, here's inspiration. You can then use it later to re-roll, and there you go. That's it. That's the system. That's about as simple as you can make it without getting into points or any other chips or things that you pass back and forth like fate. I wouldn't go, as Teo said, I wouldn't go any further than that. I wouldn't, if this is your first time GMing, GM, right? Don't worry about that. Everybody have fun. Role play to your heart's content. If players are doing things that their character would do and they're all happy with it and it tells a good story, then just go more gently on them later. If they put themselves into a horrible position, help them find a way out of that because they are telling a story, understanding the flaws of their characters.
And that's maybe one last thing to very quickly touch on, which is that when you lean into flaws too much, one of the problems, if everybody's not on board, is if I do my hot-headed where I'm going to wreck the encounter and the other players will not enjoy that. And we're all pretending we're kind of actors, if that makes sense. And this is what my character would do, right? But at some point, we're also in the shared experience of trying to accomplish goals. And I shouldn't just take my essence and wreck a scene, right? I might complicate a scene, and there's a real difference there. And so one of the questions that a lot of the advice that we often provide on the show is for folks, it sort of assumes that the players are at the sort of the same level of experience, but they may not know how to handle these things. And so you have to tease out, where are my players, right? What are my players, how are they going to respond to these systems that I'm creating? because they may respond really well because they get it, or they may not get it. And they may just say, well, this is what my character would do. I've got this flaw. So sorry, everybody. You know, I am attacking the king.
Right. Exactly. Yep. So three great questions this week. Thank you all very much. At the end of the show, we'll tell you how you can reach out and ask us a question. But let's get into our news and commentary section right now, starting with a Kickstarter that is including D&D Beyond integration in it. This is the Monsters of Drakenheim Kickstarter coming from the Dungeon Dudes and Ghostfire Gaming. If you ever imagined this would happen, you know, mark this off. Mark all 25 squares on your bingo card, because this is different. So what this Kickstarter allows you to do is certain tiers will have virtual tabletop support. So if you choose that part, that tier that includes it, or if you get an add-on where you purchase that VTT support, at the end of the Kickstarter, you will be able to choose which VTT you want to get this content through. And we've seen this before, right? Well, we have Roll20 support. We have Fantasy Ground support. We have other VTT support. This is the first time that you are seeing you will get D&D Beyond support for this content, which means that Ghostfire Gaming had to sit down with D&D Beyond and Wizards of the Coast to work all of this out ahead of time. It's just one more step in the opening up of D&D Beyond and Wizards of the Coast to third-party content. So all this talk of a walled garden, is the walls of this garden, if you even believed it in the first place, are disintegrating rapidly.
Sean, I'll tell you that I believed in the walled garden for the simple purpose or reason of it's hard technologically to monitor all these things, right? And like, and I've said this before, but if I look at my D&D Beyond screen and the list of sources, and you end up with all these, you know, Sojkanth takes up a slot and the Dungeon Dudes and the Kobold Press and everything, and suddenly it becomes really hard to find all the products. And you have to code for all of this in the D&D Beyond system, and DMs have to deal with the like, oh, I took a Mark of Eberron and a Drakenheim, blah, 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 and a do-do-do-do-do, and the DM's like, what is all this stuff? I just wanted you to choose stuff from the player's handbook. Yeah, well, we don't know what's from what. Deal.
Yeah.
Right? Look, for all those reasons and other technical reasons, like people being busy, I didn't think that they would open it this wide. Now that I see it this wide, I think to myself, wow, there are so few barriers to this wall, at least around major players, that I wonder what else is being planned, because this is so substantial an undertaking. Like the kind of discussions to say, hey, we're going to have the Kickstarter, and it's going to release this list of backers, and we're going to give it to you, and you're going to do this. Like, that's such a dedication of resources that I think, well, there's a lot that could happen more beyond this. And so I'm very eager, very interested to see what comes in the future, because this is pretty darn fascinating and well beyond what I would have expected.
Yep. And to be clear, I am a contractor for Ghostfire. I am not directly involved in the planning of this Kickstarter. I may come in at the end to help out with some game design stuff, editing, that sort of thing. But I don't know any behind the scenes knowledge of this. And I was as surprised as anyone when I saw the that virtual tabletop aspect of it up there.
Yeah, though you and I are good at compartmentalizing, right? Yesterday was the anniversary of the D&D movie, and it made me remember, and by chance I was putting up a poster of the movie on my wall, and it made me remember that, you know, for many, many months I sat with the knowledge of the D&D script, and you and I had many conversations. You would say things like, I wonder if this movie is going to be any good, and I'd be like, yeah, it's on everybody's mind. And I didn't say, like, I know the answer. I've read the script. Because for a project, I had read the script. But right. You know, like, I think you and I are good at compartmentalizing. And I think folks who watch the show a lot know that. Like, we're able to sequester that part of our brain that knows some business reality or whatever. And the part that says, well, what would I think if I didn't know that? Well, you know, here's what I would think.
Yeah. Here's what I think. Right. And so that Kickstarter's up. It's been out there for about 5 days now as of this recording. It's already up over 670,000 after that week. It could hit a million. That's been very rare. Used to for a while back in the 2000, 2019, 2020, 2021, like it seemed like every day there was a new $1 million RPG Kickstarter.
I mean,
And
not
now
quite,
it's
but yeah, and I think that the particularly interesting part is there are many more big Kickstarters now in terms of like that would have hit a million. And so that may be part of it, in addition to just post-pandemic type reality. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It used to it felt that way, right? And now it's harder. It's a harder thing to hit big numbers.
It slowed down a bit. So you can find a link to that Kickstarter, The Monsters of Drakenheim, in our show notes. And speaking of prices and quality and the direction of the hobby, we have two stories. The first from Gary Kahn, where it was said that the core book prices would remain the same as they were in 2014. Teos, what do you have to cover on
Yeah,
that?
in a seminar this was mentioned. So we'll see. You know, it's kind of not super confirmed. Just it was a thing said at the seminar by D&D staff. So that is really interesting because you know the core book prices come from 2014. They were very reasonable back then for all the value that the books offer. And so keeping them at this level when Wizards has said, oh, our prices of shipping, printing, everything have gone up. Well, then Wizards is taking a hit on that profit. Because they want the purchase of these books to be more compelling. And that's just interesting. So that's all we know at this time. If it is that case, then that's very interesting, right? They're trying to make those books as attractive as possible to you.
Yep. And one of the reasons might be our next bit of news, which is the ICV2 reports on D&D being down, but the hobby in general is up due to miniatures.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go ahead with this. You're better at this than I am.
Yeah, I mean, ICV2 is always interesting. You know, they have limited windows into everything. They reach out to certain stores, certain distributors, and kind of build data based off of that and extrapolate. They've been wrong in the past, but they're often right. And this corroborates with kind of the analysis we've done on our Discord and that I've blogged about, where we looked and said, you know, probably D&D is down a fair bit. So ICV2 says the hobby, all of the hobby games market is up 1%. That's less than inflation. And the whole reason for that growth is miniatures and collectible games doing well. So that's your Warhammer, your Magic, Pokemon, collectible miniatures, that kind of thing, right? WizKids blind boxes. When you get to all the other forms, all the other forms are down. Now, it isn't necessarily terrible. It's kind of like when we talked about Kickstarter many shows ago. You know, down to what, right, is what I always like to ask. And we are at sort of record highs for the industry. So going down from those record highs, you're still in really solid ground. The market, they say, has grown 70% the past 3 years. So being up 1%, not the end of the world. Miniature games grew about 9%. That's a total of 575 million. Games Workshop was around 15% for the year increase. So, you know, clearly they're doing well. And their problem is apparently getting enough supply. There's a line about WizKids miniatures cooling in demand, but this isn't a part that maybe what they're talking about is the Nalzors line, which is still the number two in non-collectible miniatures. But whether that includes the blind boxes and stuff, I'm not clear on how wide that statement was about the demand cooling for WizKids. Collectible games were up around 3%. Board games, card games, RPG sales all down. They did say that consumption can increases, and I love the quote, the American consumer is a tough beast to bring down. yeah. Publishers continue to publish faster, shortening development and manufacturing, and one could maybe say perhaps overwhelming the market at times. Store traffic is reportedly back to pre-COVID levels or above, but costs are higher, especially labor and rent. Store counts are about flat to maybe a little bit up, the number of stores. Sales are up around 2%, 15th consecutive year of growth for stores, but they predict next year will be down. And Ian World has a pro subscription to ICV2. They report that D&D is said to be down 30% in hobby stores. I, you know, take that number with a grain of salt, given ICV2's history, but you know, it is likely that stores have slowed a fair bit overall. They say that the OGL crisis impacted some lifestyle longtime gamers, but but newer plays as a whole seem largely oblivious to the situation, and that the move to digital has impacted sales. So, you know, we shared in our show notes a graph of what the hobby games market is. So even if we drop a fair bit, we'll still be way above 2019, which we all said was a perfectly wonderful year. So not a bad place to be, but we know how companies are. They always want endless growth. And in that sense, that's a tough thing to deal with.
Yeah. If growth is incredible and then growth is minuscule, you take that as being down when it's actually pretty good growth. So hang in there for that. We will continue to keep an eye on trends like that, especially going into 2024, the new books, and then 2025 to see what sales are like there. You want a free adventure? We gotcha. You want two free adventures? We gotcha twice. You can download Descent into the Lost Caverns of Silcanth for free. The supplement is part of a year-long celebration of D&D and its 50th anniversary. This is an abridged quick play version of the Lost Caverns of Silcanth, which will appear in a 5e form in the quests from the Infinite Staircase. So this particular adventure, which is free on D&D Beyond, is for 4 to 6 characters of 9th level. This is a revised version of the AD&D adventure where monsters have been updated. The text has been, yep, Teus is holding it up right now. The text has been rewritten. And Teus, what do you feel about the classic adventures being redone?
I mean, so one thing is, man, like the old map, I love seeing the new version of this map. It looks wonderful. I actually like monsters or adventures being revised, right? So when I look at this text, I go, hey, I already have this text. I have it in various formats. Sometimes it's been, you know, republished or whatever. We've advanced a lot as a hobby. So make this experience even better. As good as the original is, make it better. And they have done that, or at least they've attempted to do that. This is not like some of the earlier anthologies where they just sort of largely reprinted things and just, you know, modified the monster to be a CR pick. Here they've made the changes. Like the big wall of text is rewritten to be short and concise. They've simplified encounters. They've changed out what monster it is. They didn't customize the monster. They give you a different one and that kind of thing. I think that's good. I think that's largely a decent use of a designer's time to update this for today's era and make it a better venture. Yeah, it won't be the classic in terms of that absolute experience, but I think that's okay. I don't think people really need that. If you want the classic, grab the classic and do the customizing, you know, the updating the monsters yourself. But in general, I think that's great. That's what I'm paying for, is for the staff to update things to the best. Do you agree? Do you want the classic to be more true?
No, I'm with you. I've seen the classic already. I, like you, probably have a copy. I could buy a copy for quite cheap on D&D Beyond, I'm sure. So I want this to be something that I can use right now with 5e rules. It's like we talked about at the start of the show, right? Making the adventure playable with the rules that you have. I'd love to look at what Dan Dillon and Justice Armin did to make it playable in this edition. I believe there are also pre-generated characters that can go with it. It has tournament scoring.
Yeah.
So if you want to play it through to see how well you score, maybe game master it for two different groups and you can have a little competition. There are rules in there for that.
I was going to say D20 Play, we've mentioned a couple times, and you can, I think this Thursday, so the day after this drops, you could sign up to play with Tom Christie, who's running through Start Playing Games.
There you go. The second adventure is one that we just learned about being available, although we've talked about it before, is the LEGO adventure. How did you get an early copy of this, Teus?
I signed up as a LEGO insider, and you sign up and create an account on the LEGO thing. You find, finally, after much searching, the LEGO insider page, and then you go to redeem points. And when you go to redeem, there'll be a 0-point D&D adventure, and you can download the PDF now without waiting for it to come out. And it's interesting. The adventure is a sort of simple, like, how do we work around this Lego structure and have an adventure? If I understand correctly, it was written by Kyle Brink.
No, it was Chris Perkins wrote it.
Oh, Chris
Kyle's
Perkins.
the,
Oh, he's the product lead. He led the product. Yeah. So Chris Perkins wrote the adventure. Janneke Carter edited. So there are a couple things, right? It's for fifth level characters. And probably everybody goes, well, how's that even possible? It's like, well, because you have a red dragon in it. So darn, we gotta make it harder. It's a huge red dragon, right? And there's displacer beasts, and there are, all kinds of other critters that are classic monsters. And this is one of the problems with D&D. When you want those classic monsters in it, well, level one is a little hard to do. Though they probably could have done it. I can think of ways to do it, but they didn't. They went for fifth level characters. And very interestingly, they have the characters in there, but then they also have a one-page version of rules to non-D&D run it. And it's literally things like make a coin flip to see if you were hit, and other bits like that. And I thought that was very interesting that they kind of chose to do it that way. Last bit, I'll shut up. They didn't mention or link to the D&D basic rules, and I find that just fascinating.
There are pre-generated characters, simplified character sheets. So if you want to play it with your own characters, you can. If you want to use these simplified, not as simplified as we did for Peril and Pinebrook, but still simplified character sheets, you can find those in the product. Or as Teo said, there is a way to run it as its very own game. If you get hit, rather than taking damage, you fall down. And if you fall down, you can't do anything until you stand back up. And if you stand back up, that's your turn. And if you get knocked down three times, your character is out of the combat for the entire rest of the encounter. And if everybody gets knocked down three times, then you have failed in your mission. And there are also ways to remove pieces from your Lego minifig. And if you remove pieces from your Lego minifig, you can no longer use that piece that you have removed. So you have certain objects. So if you remove your Warhammer, you can no longer use your Warhammer. So it's a really neat way to play with Legos, play a D&D-like game without actually getting into those D&D rules. So I thought that was
Yeah.
very clever, and I enjoy it. I'm
I do
almost
like
tempted
that.
to play it that way.
The losing your piece of equipment when you fail save is neat. I would have liked a few more things like that, right? Like something in the adventure that will, stick this to the character's head, the minifig's head, or I don't know, put this under their feet because they're on fire or something. That would have been really a lot of fun if that could have been worked in, but you know how it is with these projects. It's hard to design. You never know when the design comes in versus all the other pieces.
It's amazing that any of these projects actually get through to completion. So we will take joy in the fact that it's there. And hey, DMs, game masters, you love minis, or you love Legos. Sorry. In America, we say Legos, but I have been told by a reputed source that it's actually Lego. So you love Lego. You love playing with all the Lego. So just make it up as you go. Add Thor's hammer. Add a lightsaber. Use all those wonderful pieces of Lego that you have to enhance this story. This week on Mastering Dungeons, our main topic is going to be part two of designing a starting adventure for your role-playing game campaign. We have created a village in the past. Last time we talked about doing a session zero, starting with a bang, creating interesting hooks to bring your players in and their characters into your adventure. So now let's talk about designing the adventure itself. A few caveats. We're going to talk about not teaching new players, not being a new DM, just you've got the group of players, you've played before, everyone knows what they're doing. So we're going to get into this adventure in that way. And also, there's going to be a difference between creating an adventure for your home group versus writing something that's going to be playable by all players and any DM who picks it up. The closer you are to the players and their characters, the more you can integrate those characters and their knowledge of the setting into the campaign and the adventures that you're writing. We talked, I think, a bit about using backgrounds and factions for integrating the characters into your setting, whether it's the town, the adventure, the campaign as a whole. So make good use of the backgrounds, either creating your own in the adventure or using the ones that your characters will have access to bring them into the meat of the story in a more integrated way. Anything else you want to remind folks of or mention before we dig into the first encounter?
No, I think that's great. Like you're saying, purposeful design, right? Like think through what they've seen and what they haven't. And that's the one of the kind of hardest parts of I think what we're talking about is that it really rests on what you have done with that introduction that we talked about, right? How you've built out this town, how you've set up for these scenes, what are the hooks that you've done? Because all of that hook building could have really built a nice solid base so that this encounter can really fly. Or you might deliberately be bringing them in cold, and this first encounter is going to teach them a lot. And so where you are in that gradient of really nicely prepped for all of the themes and concepts, or getting them in the face during this encounter, well, you be aware of that and be purposeful in the design. So, because I think, in general, almost always at the end of this encounter, you want to have a good feel for the types of things that are going on, or at least really solid interest to figure that out.
Sure. And so that brings us to we've got the characters hooked in some way into this. They want to take part in this adventure. So let's talk about that first encounter that you're going to create. The kind of encounter you're going to create, what's included in it, will depend on what is the goal for your adventure and what is the goal for your campaign as a whole. So that goal for this first adventure that you run your characters through will determine the structure, the best structure for this encounter. So, for example, if this were a one shot, you only want to give the players and their characters as much information as they need to move on to the next, because at the end, you're just going to move, go your separate ways. So, you only want to give the information that they need. But since we're talking about a longer term campaign here, there are some things to be aware of. You want to introduce as much as you can about the adventure in the campaign and the character's special place within the adventure in the campaign, but you don't want to overwhelm them with too much information too quickly. You're going to have them hopefully for several adventures, so you can dole out that information as needed or as it brings interest to the story. Don't hand them a map and a key with 47 different sites in the town and a description of right every NPC and what they do and how they look. That's going to be overwhelming them. Maybe at the end of the first adventure, you give them that afterwards so they can study it and learn, but you don't want to overwhelm them with that information. That's way too much. Just start with the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like one of the things I like to think about is the difference in city design, right? Like Baldur's Gate has these three areas for the outside, the walls part. And that becomes a really easy thing both for GM and players to understand. And it creates already a picture of this inequality that exists in Baldur's Gate. And then you can say, well, we're going to be in this area. What is there in this area? Oh, there are the docks, there's the blah, right? That helps. Or if you think of Waterdeep and sort of it has the different wards, right? That kind of neighborhood type concept is very helpful because we don't need to tell them what's in all the neighborhoods. We can just name some of them. And from that, the players can say, well, we need to go to the dock ward. What can I find in the dock ward? And then we can get into that, and it's tangible, it's relevant, and it won't overwhelm because we can just go into the particular mission concept we're going for.
And so these are the questions I like to ask when I'm creating a starting adventure in a campaign. It's what is the setting? Not just the narrow setting where the characters will start, i.e., the village that we created. But what is the setting as a whole? What are some details of this setting that I can sprinkle in just a tiny bit of to get across to the players, this is where you are. A Dragonlance first encounter. I want to be different than an Eberron first encounter, that I want to be different from a Dark Sun first encounter. So I want to, even if it's emphasize sand in one, emphasize a lightning rail in another, and then emphasize what's a good one for
Yeah,
Dragonlance?
the army people and the
Knights of Salamnia.
right. Yeah, refugees, that kind of thing, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So find at least one hook into the setting and put that hook in place to be able to describe that. And then in the next encounter, maybe a different detail. The next encounter, a different detail. Just so it slowly builds up over time. Especially emphasize those differences if your players are used to a typical, like high fantasy or sword and sorcery
Yeah,
setting.
good point.
Emphasize those. So
Yeah,
if you
and
could,
I
oh,
might
go
just
ahead.
add to this that if the place where you are is fantastic, don't not cover that, right? So fourth edition organized play adventures a lot of times tried to keep things, and this was a mandate from up high, tried to keep things low lore. But what that sometimes translated to was you could be in a world that literally had a city, the town that had floating earth moats
I
and
was thinking the
waterfalls
same
coming out
thing.
of nowhere, and nobody would describe this to you. So you just felt like you were in an everyday town. And I'm like, wait, are we in this place? Because this place is fantastic. Why is the DM and the adventure not describing this? Well, it's trying to keep it simple. Lean into that cool stuff. Like, if the place is fantastic in some way, make sure that's tangible and known, and it should play out in some way, right?
And as you were saying that, I was thinking of the exact place in the 4E Forgotten Realms, Akanol, right,
Akanol,
which had the floating moats and the waterfalls coming off of them. And that's a great point. If you are publishing something with a company that has lore and they don't want you to create new lore, what they're talking about is not atmosphere. They're talking about don't say that this inn has been there forever and is owned by this person who is linked to Elminster and right. But these descriptions, this flavor, you can still put into the adventure.
Yeah, and the theme, I mean, like we talked about Dragonlance, right? The first organized play Dragonlance adventure that's out through Baldwin Games is great because it really does help you see refugees, somebody who's a kind of a spy or undercover from Team Evil, the Knights of Salamnia and what they stand for. All these things come out in little bits and pieces as you're in these different village scenes, and that helps you really grasp this world and this story and differentiate it from any other experience without getting in the way of the encounter design. It's just part of it, right? It's there to help color, and that's really nice design.
And that's the second question I would ask. Is there an atmosphere, a tone, a theme, etc., that you're going to be trying to reinforce in this campaign? And so you want to add those details in the first encounter, if possible, with bonus points if you can let the characters directly interact with those elements. So if you are in a high intrigue campaign where there is three or four power groups struggling for dominance through intrigue, you want to be able to say to the rogue character, hey, there is a criminal organization here. When you reach out to your criminal contacts, you meet this NPC. Let's role play this out. And so let them interact with that and make an intrigue plot point right away. Give that rogue like a secret mission. Or if there's a holy order that's involved and you have the cleric of the party or the paladin who is somehow related, give them something special to do, to be heroic in this good versus evil campaign that you're running.
Yeah, and along themes, that colors encounter design too. So if we know that we're going to be dealing with cult of a dead god or god of death, then we may want to start out with a quest that takes us to a graveyard because it starts coloring that experience, right? Or dealing with somebody who recently passed away and what secrets they left behind, or something like that, but tying into that overall theme of death and so on. Whereas if we take people to a graveyard, but the theme of this is dragons and there's nothing draconic at the graveyard, then it's disassociated and that can be okay. But maybe we'd like to instead try to add something to it so the theme is interesting, right? The person in the graveyard was a dragon slayer of renown, right? Or there are draconic inscriptions on the headstone. Any little thing helps us start to build towards where we're going and gets us into the heads of the player characters, have it in their heads what the theme is.
The first encounter for Acquisitions Incorporated is you in the headquarters trying to get permission to have a franchise, and you are mistaken for a very powerful group. Right. So it doesn't start out with a combat, but it starts out with this. We already know that this is going to be a comedy of errors, a bunch of chaos of taking advantage of a situation when it is presented to you. You meet the important NPCs right away, Omen Dran and Jim Darkmagic. That campaign, the sort of funny satire humor you're getting hit with right in the first encounter.
Yeah, and then the things you face when you go to the first combat area and in the second as well are all tying towards the theme of what the big bad will eventually be, so that it starts
Sure.
building towards that.
So that leads me to the next point, which I ask when I design a first adventure, first encounter, is who are the antagonists? Is it a group of evil fanatics? Okay. I'm going to introduce that in this first encounter. Not directly. I'm not going to say, oh, and now you know that, evil Lord so and so is the bad guy. No, you just meet a low-level flunky of the sub-lieutenant of the stenographer of Lord so-and-so, but you're on that track now. If the antagonists are rich merchants, then you want in this first encounter to see someone being taken advantage of in a business transaction, and you will then get that theme reinforced right away. Think about the antagonists and how to portray them at this very low, very subtle level.
Yeah, and it can be fun. Sometimes antagonists might be a little generic, which is fine, but if we say, well, we're going up against merchants or bandits, that's perfectly fine. But what if we could theme it a little bit more, right? Like if they are merchants that tend to be of items of war, right? Used for war, and that ties into the plot, it'll be easier to theme it. Or if the bandits are in league with a cult or follow a dark god or something like, or are associated with an evil nation or something like that, it helps us color it a bit more so that we can have stronger theming around it, right? Or maybe the leader has a particular theme to them, and that ties over to ways that they act, and that can help too, right? Elemental evil in the classic adventure, right? Temple of Elemental Evil, you have these elemental forces. It makes it very easy to theme that.
I was thinking again, I was thinking element, Village of Hamlet, and how, if there are bandits that are out there raiding caravans, you go to the Inn of the Welcome Wench and you order a beer, but oh, sorry, we're all out of beer. All we have is wine, and it's really expensive because the bandits have hit the caravans that were bringing the beer, so we have no beer, right? That gets it's very simple. But it gets the point across right away. Okay, these are the consequences. And I'll get to that in a second, actually. But there you go. And the last thing I ask myself is, who are the PC's allies, or who are other NPCs who are going to be important in this campaign? You want to, if possible, get them in, even if not in the first encounter, something about them or what they stand for. So if there is going to be a sheriff who the characters rely on for information, have that sheriff show up soon. If there's some representative of the Lord Mayor or the Queen, get them involved as soon as possible as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's really nice when the characters and the players understand that they are part of a larger whole, with these allies and NPCs that are impacted by their success or failure. And so if you do something like, you defeat a sub-villain and you find, plans to attack this particular NPC. That's great. Right now that ties them into the fabric of this village that we're dealing with. Or if, a particular person is a resource, right? The ranger in town is a little eccentric, but knows about the wild beasts that have been acting strangely lately. That gives us a resource to reach out to, and there may be more down the road. Maybe we bring them the strange herbal thing we found, and we ask them about it, right? That kind of thing. That link that pays off over time strengthens your village, which you spent time on, and means that it'll continue to be relevant as the adventure progresses.
So we've got that first encounter where we want to do, you can't do all of this without very, very careful writing. So it's okay if you just do one or two of these things, but you want that at top of mind as you create further encounters. So speaking of further encounters, what you have to decide also is how long do you want this first adventure to be? Do you want to run this huge long 8-hour epic? Do you want to run a 4-hour adventure? Do you want this campaign to consist of like 2-hour adventures? Or do you only have time to plan your lunch break, so you're going to have a campaign of 1-hour sessions? Whatever that length of time is, you want it to speak to what the campaign is going to be. It can be problematic to run one 8-hour session and then do a 1-hour session and then, oh, we can get a 4-hour session and cool. Nope, this is only 2, because it makes it uneven. It makes, you can do it, but it makes it harder for you as the game master. And it makes it harder for the players to understand the flow of what you're going for in your campaign.
And ideally, you want to end sessions either on a resolution or a cliffhanger, right? And ideally, in a perfect world, a little bit of both, right? We defeated the evil, but oh, look, there's this clue to the next thing. Da da da, Oh, there they've it says here that the attack is underway. We got to get back to the village. That is super fun. And you'll only know that if you're writing to the cadence of what you expect play to be. And that can be your own game, right? Like I tend to run now less 4-hour adventures and more 3 to 3.5 hour gaming sessions with my group because of people needing to get up for work the next day and things like that. So I write to that in my home campaign, but for published, I might write for 4 hours. And so, yeah, you think through that cadence.
So each of those lengths, whether it's 4 hours, 2 hours, 1 hour, will have a different beat pattern, different pacing. With a 4-hour adventure, you're invited to create several encounters. And several encounters means you need different story beats. You need different emotional beats. You need different encounter types. You don't want to hit combat, 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 unless that's exactly what your players want. Generally, they want some role playing in there, maybe some exploration, some storytelling outside of just the combat. So you want to use a variety of those beats. With a 2-hour adventure, maybe you're just looking at a couple different beats. Maybe you're looking at sort of a setup, 2 encounters, and then a denouement, a falling action. With a 1-hour adventure, you might be able to pull off multiple beats, but most likely you're just going to have sort of rising action, stop, and then get ready for the next time. But what you do will be determined by that length. And then once you figure out the length of your adventure, you can come up with the number of encounters and the types of encounters that you deliver. The first thing that you want to make sure you do as you think of the encounters for your adventure is, did I promise anything during session zeros? Did I promise that this was going to be, right, a high intrigue, role play heavy adventure?
Right.
If you did that, you're going to need a lot of high intrigue, role play heavy encounters. Same with combat, same with exploration. Now, if you want a mix of those, then you're good. You just have to make sure you do that. But if you promised lots of combat, or if you promised lots of exploration, make sure that you give them that right away in this first adventure. A, because you promised it, but B, if it doesn't work out the way that you or the players were hoping, you still have time to fix it if you do that right away. You can stop and say, okay, that was our first adventure. How is it? How is everybody feeling? And they're like, you know what? We thought we wanted a lot of exploration, but 3 hours in, when it was all exploring, I think we want more combat. Okay, we can do that going forward.
Yeah, Ian, and if this is a campaign where like I think a lot of the Legend of the Five Rings play, the adventures, the organized play system would have adventures that would be tagged with specific words like combat role play investigation, you know, things like that. So you knew the kind of experience. But that also came from how they were writing these story arcs, where they knew this is not a campaign that's just combat, combat, combat. So we're using these tags so you can actually skip certain things depending on what you like, but we are writing for a lot of these different elements, right? We want heavy role play adventures, heavy investigation, adventures that are really about your place in society. And so that needs to happen often. And that's that kind of thing you want to go back and think about, right? The types of pillars, the themes, you know, if you promised pirates, then how are you going to keep delivering that if you don't, right? Or Ashes of Athas, you know, we wanted the town that you started in to matter a lot. And we got a little bit astray for it for complicated reasons. And then we had to come back and build that in. Otherwise, we just weren't going to hit that goal. And the end was not going to matter the way we wanted it to. So we had to go back and keep hitting on that goal, on that theme until the experience was right. So that you have that. Like if this is a story of protecting the village, you know, Seven Samurai style, then we need to care about this village. We need to understand what we're protecting. We need to probably get acquainted with its surroundings and you know, all of the facets, the groups, maybe who in town might turn against you, right? All those things. And so each encounter, each part of the adventure, we want to play out, have those things add up and be meaningful over time.
Yeah, and the final thing I will say, which is important because this is the first adventure in your campaign, is trying to work in scenes that speak specifically to individual characters while still being important and relevant to the whole party. So you can do, I have five players. I'm going to make sure I have five encounters. And in each encounter, someone gets a spotlight. How does Belinda the Barbarian feel when a person from a rival clan is sitting in the tavern in their favorite seat? They always like the end of the bar. And Wilhelmina the Barbarian is sitting there in Belinda's favorite seat. You could still do everything else, but you can focus on Belinda a little bit. And then I said before, the PC with the criminal background, if you're writing a published adventure and you don't know in each individual player, the person with the criminal background gets pulled aside at the very beginning of the campaign in this first adventure and interacted with in some way. Either, hey, you're new in town, you better not do anything because we're watching you. Or you want to get an in with us, steal this gem from this person at this point as they're walking down the street. Right. Nothing huge, nothing that will break the campaign, but get people involved as quickly as you can on an individual level as well as on a party level.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where that session zero helps too. If we know that someone's playing the ranger and they really love tracking, and someone is playing the druid and they want to, you know, save the forest that's been logged by the village and so on, you know, like these things, then we want to work those themes in, right? In fact, the evil forces want to log it, or, you know, whatever it is, or the elves can be saved and partnered with, and they will help steward the forest better. And, you know, all of that can play into our plans if we spend some time each session and each designing each session, thinking through what tweaks we can do for the characters.
Yeah. Now, I want to reiterate, all of this is ignoring like just general encounter design stuff. If you want to see my thoughts on writing an adventure, go to Let's Design an Adventure on D&D Beyond. There's 10 articles that follow one along the other to talk about adventure design. Check that out. Mm-hmm. We're specifically talking here about initial adventures for your campaign. Yeah. And for the finale of your first adventure, how do you handle that? What you want to do is show the characters the consequences of their successes and their failures played out in that finale. To end the first session, you want to resolve those first important questions, but also open up new questions that the players will be exploring in future adventures and throughout the campaign. So in that first adventure, especially if it's a longer adventure, you want there to feel like there was a resolution. Undead were coming out of the graveyard. We have to find out why that is. Oh, that is so because there was an evil artifact placed in the mausoleum at the center that was sending out necromantic waves that brought the dead back to life. Okay, we found it. We destroyed it. Okay, we did that. But the question is, who put it there? The question is, why did they put it there? What, you know, those things, maybe there were special gold engravings on it that were made with gold from a nearby mine. Okay, mm-hmm. That leads us to that. So you want to resolve while also opening up new things. And Teos mentioned this earlier as well.
You know, if we just do something as simple as say, okay, there are cultists. They're going to sacrifice the town mayor because of her lineage or something like that. And so they, you know, we're going to arrive just in time as the ritual is happening and we're going to stop it. That's fine, right? That's good. There are clear consequences for what you did, clear resolution, you saved or did not save them. The mayor is going to be happy, but we can do more than that by having some interesting pieces to the puzzle. Like maybe there is something that the ritual hinges upon that we can use to counter it. And we learned this earlier. Do the players do that thing? Because it also has a drawback. Mm-hmm. Now the end scene will have an additional payoff where you get to see that impact, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe there are some parts when you were dealing in the village, learning about all these setups where you could have really impressed the town mayor before they were kidnapped. Mm-hmm. Now the payoff could be bigger when they are set free because of that additional work you did, or you consolidated power with some other groups that were squabbling or something like that. All of it could mean that at the end of the adventure, maybe the mayor rewards them with something like the deed to a place, mm-hmm. right? Or running a certain thing, playing a role for the town. That could all be really interesting. And extend that sort of consequence and success state to make it more interesting. You don't have to do that, but it's an option to think through whether you want to have that kind of a little more teeth, a little more payoff, something a little more permanent. You brought up the artifact, right? Maybe you could have destroyed it, or you could have put it back where it came from. And those can have different implications depending on which way you go. And that could pay off in that end scene too.
Yeah. And you'd mentioned cliffhangers before. And I want to speak to that because we tend to think of cliffhangers as bringing excitement and bringing a sense of anticipation. And you want to use that anticipation to its highest degree. So ending in the middle of combat. Some people say, well, it's a cliffhanger, right? We went into this area where we thought that the cult was operating, and all of a sudden a dragon swoops down and breathes on us. All right, we take 23 points of acid damage from this black dragon. Oh, and that's the end. That is a cliffhanger. But it might not be the cliffhanger that you want, because what will happen is the players will be focused not on, oh, did we find the cultists or not? Oh, did we do the right thing when we came to this place? All they're thinking is, okay, so we need to find some way to deal with this acid. How are we going to kill this dragon? That can be good, but it's a very short-term cliffhanger. You want them to be pondering the longer-term plots, the longer-term things that are investing them in the whole campaign, not just in this one encounter.
I agree. I mean, I don't tend to use a lot of cliffhangers for that reason. I rather would have it be a little more like a TV show serial episodes where it's like sort of, quiet ending, good, strong resolution. Then you start, whether it's an exciting start, but it's a new start or it's an introduction, and then we get into the meat of it and resolve it again.
So just think about where you want your players' focus and cliff hang where you want their focus to be. You want what they will be thinking about in the week or the 2 weeks or however long between sessions. And if you do that, things we just talked about, you will have, I think, created a fine opening adventure for your tabletop role-playing game slash D&D campaign. So overall, then, at the end of that first adventure, your character should understand the setting, understand its tone, and some of the major elements of the campaign, NPCs, power groups, etc. They should have a clear understanding of the first steps of the campaign. What are their goals going to be going forward? How are they going to go about achieving those goals? They should have an idea of different directions they could take when they start the next session. They should understand what's at stake. And it may be a small stake to start out with. It may just be trying to protect the mayor from future cult attacks. It could be being, it could be world shattering if you want to start with that right away. It could be the rain of fire as the dragons come down. That could be if you want to go big, if you want to go epic. They'll understand that right away. That's okay too. But they should understand that if they fail to act, these are going to be the consequences of the action. You will have a world of undead creatures if you don't stop this necromancy cult from spreading beyond this town. And give them leads, give them a place to explore next, a person to question next, something that where they know when they sit down that this is going to be the next step in our adventure.
Yeah, I love that. And there's so many parts of this that you can tweak, right? If you think of these as different dials, like the setting and tone, and you can draw from that and dial certain parts up and down. The villains, the stakes, the characters themselves, right? All of these are different elements you can play with that can make things really exciting, right? So if we say like if I think of I think it's Shotguns on Sorcery, the setting, it has this idea that everybody is in a city with all these undead outside, and I think ruled by a dragon, but there are these different power groups, right? And so it's very easy to understand the setting and the tone and the constraints. We're all in the city, outside death, don't let the undead in. But now we can think through, okay, what is my first step in the campaign and where am I going with this? Like maybe I'm going with there's somebody from the inside who's looking to let the undead in, right? But that might start with something like merchants fighting and disrupting the power balance. And so we can develop all these different pieces. And well, what are the characters tied to? So where are the characters going to go with this? And all of that becomes a little bit of a mess, but to me, that's my favorite thing, right? I like to sort of think of a mess of stuff and then simplify it down to clear things that happen in the adventure. but that will link with these strong themes to the PCs, to the villains, to the plot where it's going, to the setting. And that's how you get a really great experience, right?
That's right. So we hope this has been helpful to you in creating an adventure to launch your campaign. Thank you so much for everyone who's listening and who has been contacting us to tell us that they like what we've been covering. Some of them have even become patrons of our show, and we appreciate that. We've had a few new patrons recently. Thank you. If you would like to become a patron of the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/masteringDnd and supporting us in any way that you see fit. And we appreciate that. We have many Master of Dungeon supporters. We have a few Master of the Realm supporters, and we do have a select group who have become supporters that we call Masters of the Multiverse. So we want to thank Chris Webster. I said it right this time. Javier Wasiak, I probably said it wrong this time. Graham Ward, James Walton, Joe Tyler, Trace, Krishna Simonse, Andy Shockney, Ross Sandberg, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Vladimir Prunner from Croatia, Robert Pasley, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Mighty Zeus, Mike Olson, Tom Nelson, who created the Deck of Player Safety, which is sitting on my shelf right there. Falcon Neal, Sean Molly, John Mickey, Eric Menge, the Mathemagician, Chad Lynch, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Brian King, Chad Jackson, Sean Hurst, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, The Mighty Jerd, Nathan Fuller, Andy Edmonds at nerdronomicon.com, Evil John, Merrick Blackman, Steve Bissonette, Craig Bailey, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, not Crazy Wolf Studios, and finally, Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Thank you so much for being Masters of the Multiverse for us. Thank you to all our listeners and to all our patrons. If you like the show, do consider supporting the Patreon. Also, if you get a chance, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or by whatever means you listen to this podcast. And if you watch us on YouTube, you can subscribe, which would bump us up the list of shows that you want to see more of. Teos, where can people find you and your work?
Find me at alphastream.org. And yeah, I posted on Mastodon pictures of my gaming room, which is starting to come together. I'm very happy. I hung up 3 different pieces of art last weekend out of the many to choose from. It's fun.
Nice. You can find me on all the socials at Sean Merwin. You can follow the podcast at Mastering D&D on many of those platforms. You can join our community and you can communicate to us via the Patreon. You can leave comments on Mastering Dungeons YouTube channel. And there is only 2 days left when this show drops on the Surviving Strange Hollow Kickstarter. If you've backed it, I thank you so much. Please check it out in the next couple of days. See if it's something you would enjoy, and we would really appreciate the support there. The team of writers and the Accidental Cyclops folks and Emily Hare, the artist. We would love your support. So with all that said, we have finished our first adventure here in our campaign. So what are we going to do now?
Well, in addition to telling all my friends about Surviving Strange Hollow, I'm going to start applying all these concepts to my campaign world, where exercise and health have been threatened by the bunnies that chocolate eggs. Until this threat has been destroyed, our exercise, our plans, our health are threatened. What am I going to do, Sean?
I'm going to eat a lot of jelly beans and then go take a long rest.
Amen.
Amen.